Your Brain to Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.
Hi, I'm Adam.
And I'm Sabine. Welcome to the 32nd episode of Robots. In today's show, we'll be speaking with two experts in the field of brain-machine interfaces. Our first guest, Chuck Higgins from the University of Arizona, tells us how he uses insects to control robot motion and how they might be used in the future to develop new biological sensors for artificial systems.
We then speak with Steve Potter from Georgia Tech. Instead of taking a fully developed brain and connecting it to a robot, he grows neural circuitry in a petri dish. By starting from the bottom up, he hopes to be able to see just how it is that we learn and memorize. But first, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Adam. The world's largest exhibition of unmanned systems took place this week in Washington, D.C. The exhibition and conference, featuring mostly military hardware, was sponsored by the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, or AUVSI, and attracted more than 300 exhibitors, including all major government contractors. This year's event also included live demonstrations of UAVs and UGVs. Flight International magazine has compiled a timely shortlist, including technical details of the 25 UAVs to watch over the next 12 months. You may remember our previous report on the Google Lunar X Prize, which will see teams competing for more than $20 million of prize money for successfully landing a robotic vehicle on the moon and beaming back high-definition video. Toy company Lego has now taken up the ball and announced a mirror challenge for the next generation of engineers. The Moonbots Challenge allows teams of six to submit designs illustrating how they will build, program, and operate their moon robots using LEGO Mindstorms robotic kits. Entering the contest will be free for teams across the globe. The best designs will be provided with free LEGOs to actually build and program the robots, and will then compete in challenges similar to the Lunar X Prize, but on a simulated moonscape. And finally, Panasonic's Evolta robot, mentioned in our last episode, has successfully completed its challenge to enter the Guinness Book of World Record by driving around the Le Mans circuit for 24 hours and a distance of 23.726 kilometers on two AA batteries. For more information on the LEGO Moonbots Challenge, the AUVSI conference, and the Evolta robot, visit the forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Chuck Higgins is professor and leader of the Higgins Lab at the University of Arizona. Though he started as an electrical engineer, his fascination with the natural world has led him to study insect vision and visual processing, and to try to meld together the worlds of robotics and biology. He tells us about his most recent work in trying to use the amazing visual system of the dragonfly as a sensor to control a robot, and in turn learn more about insect neurobiology.
So hi, Chuck. Welcome to the Robots Podcast.
Hi, Adam.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work to our listeners?
Sure. I'm an associate professor of electrical engineering and of neurobiology at the University of Arizona. And I'm interested in insect vision and especially in insect visual navigation. So I'd like to try and figure out how neurons underlie what insects do while they're flying, because I'd like to be able to build artificial things that can do that.
From your background, are you more of a biologist or more of an engineer?
Well, that's changed somewhat in the last decade. So my PhD is in electrical engineering, but right after that I did a postdoc in biology, and I've spent the last 10 years as a professor doing computational neuroscience and working with neurobiologists. So I'm about half and half now. I guess more than half of my work is aimed at pure science goals, just trying to understand how something in the insect visual system works. But I still have the deep core of my interest is still an engineer's interest, really trying to engineer creations that are like the biology that I see. But fundamentally, I don't think I have the knowledge to engineer something like a dragonfly or like a fly. I want to study the science more before I feel like I'm ready to build those things.
Okay, so you want to first gain the basic knowledge before you attack the engineering problem.
Yeah, and I've become just fascinated with the science of the subject. So I just am really interested in observing how neurons work and how they interconnect and what kind of networks they make. And I'd love to figure out some general, if you will, reverse engineering paradigm for making neural systems and be able to engineer an insect to do whatever I want.
Well, it sounds fascinating. So let's start maybe with the biology part. Tell us maybe about your work with insects and flies and dragonflies and what you hope to learn specifically about these great creatures.
Well, so I've been interested in flying insects for some time. And again, that's a collaboration that I started here at the University of Arizona with some really awesome insect scientists. And so one of the things that I've been studying as a computational neuroscientist is how visual subsystems are put together that subserve specific tasks. So, for example, target tracking in a dragonfly, there are photoreceptors and there are visual motion detectors, and then finally there are descending neurons that take you down to motor movements that cause a dragonfly to track a mosquito and eventually eat it. So dragonflies, like other insects, don't do a whole lot of thinking about this. They're sort of, if you will, a bit oversimplified, hardwired pathways that go from the vision system down to the motor system, and this pathway subserves a specific behavior. And I don't want to oversimplify the system, but fundamentally what I'm interested in is all these sort of visuomotor pathways, and mapping out one after the other, you start to see the pattern of how they're all interconnected. And so that's what I've been working on for quite some time.
So what you're trying to say is that in these insects, it seems like the brain is almost passed by. There's a direct connection between the eye and the motors. Or is that oversimplifying too much?
That connection is the brain. The connection between the eye and the motor is the brain. But what I'm trying to say is, in a human, there's all this cognition, prefrontal cortex, all this stuff that goes on where humans consider whether to do this, they figure out how to do that. Humans are very, very general organisms. We can do 100 different things to any given visual stimulus, whereas insects generally are not. Insects, if there's a dragonfly sitting around that's reasonably hungry and a mosquito flies by, 99% of the time it will take off and try to eat it. And it's not going to be thinking about its girlfriend and be depressed and decide it's not going to do that today. For reasons that are perhaps obvious, they have to survive in the world. They really don't need those sort of that sort of detail, and so they're much more directly predictable. And again, it's not that they're 100% without any ability to make decisions, but there definitely are these reflex pathways that they can, to some extent, turn on and off. And that's what I'm interested in studying. It's not like every visual input goes into cortex, and then cortex thinks about it and then decides what to do with the motor system. It's much more like visual pathways go to premotor pathways, and those premotor pathways lead directly to motor centers. And you can trace it from sensation all the way out to motor.
So how do you trace it? Maybe tell us kind of visually how you work on these insects and how you figure out exactly what they're thinking, I guess, or how their neurons are set up.
Okay, so this happens through a collaboration of a lot of different scientists. So this brain is very, very small. And so over the years, people have studied specifically the fly brain in some great detail. So we know tremendous amounts about the anatomy of the fly brain. And that's sort of the basis for most of the stuff that I'm interested in. So we know a lot about how the visual system is put together. We know a lot about how the motor system is put together. We know a lot less about the central brain, but we do have a lot of anatomy there nonetheless. And to a very large extent, that extrapolates to other insects. So it's possible for you to, say, study a dragonfly and look at the visual system organization in an anatomical picture. So you may take a a dragonfly brain out and slice it up and look in the microscope. And this is something that's done by neuroanatomists here at the University of Arizona where I work, not by me. But they look in there and they say, oh, okay, this is a lobula. This is the same thing that a fly has. And if it's this little brain area called the lobula, then we have an idea where it is, what it connects to, and what it's for. And in the same way, there will be descending neurons that go from the central brain down towards the thoracic ganglia, towards the motor centers. And those neurons are also not like cortical neurons. Rather, they're unique. So in any given dragonfly, you will find a specific target selective descending neuron that responds to small moving targets moving a specific direction. So this is a huge difference between primates, which tend to have innumerable, almost identical neurons, sort of a population system, compared to insects that have identified unique neurons. So in a human, for any given cortical activity, if you delete a neuron, or probably even 10 neurons, there's no difference, absolutely no difference. In an insect, there is one target selective descending neuron on each side that responds to a direction of target. And if you delete that neuron, it won't see that target, one neuron. So it's a very different strategy, and that actually helps us in tracing out these pathways a lot. You can identify neurons, you can inject dye into that neuron and see, oh, okay, I know what neuron that is. And you can have a pretty good idea from comparative studies what it's going to do.
Maybe we can talk about your work on interfacing insects with robots. I found this really quite interesting, how you're trying to see how we can use an insect on a robot itself as a sensor, for example, instead of trying to build the whole robot ourselves. What can you tell us about that?
Well, a few years ago, I was designing an electronic sensor based on a portion of a fly's eye. And I believe we were going to spend $60,000 or $75,000 to fabricate that little sensor, and it was going to emulate a small portion of a fly's brain. And it occurred to me I could get an entire fly brain for far lower cost. And so I thought, what if I try to interface some part of an insect's brain to a robot and use it as a sensor? And this has a couple of goals. First of all, the way that insect vision is typically studied, really any visual system is typically studied, is by putting it down on a workbench someplace and passing visual stimuli by it. And that's not the way that visual systems are meant to be used. They're meant to go around in the world. And so if I could actually do experiments on a visual system while it's moving around in the world, that's quite a different experiment. That's something I'd be really interested to try. Secondly, if you wave your hand in front of a motion detector that's in an insect brain, you'd be surprised how much more sensitive it is than the sort of visual sensors we can build today by engineers. So I thought there might be both a scientific and an engineering goal in trying to interface insect brains as visual sensors to mobile robots. And so that's something that I've tried for quite some time.
Any results to tell us about?
Well, so the experiment I'm working on at the moment is to do with dragonflies. So it turns out the primary thing that a dragonfly is concerned with is catching mosquitoes. They'll hang around someplace on a piece of grass, wait for mosquitoes to fly by, and then jump up and eat them. And they're very, very fast, very, very good at this. And so target tracking is a really crucial part of a dragonfly's repertoire. So it turns out, without having to go into the central brain, you can record from what is effectively the spinal cord of the dragonfly. So it's pretty easy to access just below the head. You can get hold of the spinal cord, which is called the ventral nerve cord in a dragonfly. And without much work, you can access something called target selective descending neurons. So these neurons respond to up, down, left, and right, small moving targets. And it's very easy to get access to these signals without doing much damage to the insect. So what I'm trying to do at the moment is record these signals on a moving robot, figure out what the visual stimulus was, sort of the stimulus moving up, down, left, or right, and then move the robot to track the target. So we actually want to make a closed-loop target tracking system using the dragonfly visual system. And the strength of this is that there's very little damage to the insect, Basically, the insect will live until it starves to death. There's no reason why it will die of any damage that we did. So as a visual sensor, it's reasonably long-lasting, but it also gives me an opportunity to look at the responses of these target selected descending neurons in a real closed-loop visual environment, as opposed to just sticking the dragonfly down on a workbench and passing visual stimuli by it.
Do you think the dragonfly will respond the way you like it to respond? I mean, if you put it on a mobile robot, do you think, would you have to pass some mosquitoes in front of it for it to actually respond? Or do you think just driving around, it'll have enough stimulus to actually do something?
Well, the dragonfly vision is actually fairly coarse in resolution compared to human vision. So when they track a mosquito, it's basically a 1 or 2 pixel target in their vision system. So at the time they take off and start to track, they're really not able to tell whether it's a mosquito or something else. And so I'm pretty sure that the vision system will still work for small targets, even on a robot. And especially these neurons we want to record from are, even though they are truly premotor neurons, they effectively act as sensory neurons. They respond very, very reliably to small targets. So I don't expect to have any trouble to get these neurons to respond on the robot, but you bring up another interesting point. So one of the things that is most difficult for small target tracking systems is to ignore movement of the background. Mm-hmm. So now we have a system where the target is moving and the robot's going to turn to track it, and the entire background moves behind it. Okay, so this is not something that is very well studied on these neurons. So their ability to reject, say, small dots that are part of the background mosaic. And that's something I'd be very interested to try. How good are these systems at tracking small targets, even when there's background interference?
And what kind of robot are you thinking of putting a dragonfly onto? Do you think it's important that this robot has kind of the same dynamics as the dragonfly? Or can it just be a slow-wheeled robot, for example?
Well, that's a good question. So I want to start off with something really simple and primitive, which is just a slow-moving wheeled robot. And we're gonna move around on the ground in two dimensions and track targets that move left and right. We will graduate to a system where we have the dragonfly on a pan tilt head, if you will, so the dragonfly can actually turn and look in three dimensions towards a moving target and still have it on a flat robot. However, because of the way the preparation is set up and because of the electronics that's required to do this, there's no reason why in the fullness of time you couldn't actually fly this. I would be reluctant to try it on a helicopter because of the vibration, but it would be reasonable to try it on a fixed-wing vehicle without all the vibration. I think that's something that could be done. So matching it to the dynamics of a dragonfly, when you can build something that has the dynamics of a dragonfly, I'll put this on board.
Until then,
we're stuck with the rather primitive flying vehicles that we have, and it would be really interesting to try, and not impossible at all. The electronics that are required to do this are, I have it on a printed circuit board that's, let's say, 4 by 6 inches, but I have made no attempt to miniaturize it. There's actually people in the bio-interfacing community that are quite good at miniaturizing these circuits. There's absolutely no reason why this couldn't be done on a single chip. The technology exists. So if you take the dragonfly, which weighs some fraction of a gram, the electrode and some bio-interfacing chip, the real drawback, like it is for any robotic system, is going to be the battery. How heavy is the battery? But there's no reason why this couldn't be flown eventually.
So it sounds to me like you're slowly working towards, I guess, what could be called an advanced vision sensor that weighs in the couple grams that can be mounted on a robot. Does this mean that that you see some sort of actual practical application of this in the future, and that we could actually use insects on real robots that are used in the everyday, or is this really more of a scientific investigation?
Well, I sort of see both sides. So at the heart of this investigation is a science investigation. So I'm really interested in what these neurons can do and in studying them in closed-loop systems. But gradually, the more I learn about these systems as I start to be able to reverse engineer them, I can replace the biology components with artificial components, assuming I can implement it in real time and in reasonable amounts of power. So in the future, there's a couple of directions you could go. You might think, well, we will use this sort of platform to learn everything we need to know about the biological system, and we'll engineer an artificial non-living system that will replace it completely. And I'm interested in that approach as well. However, another direction you could go, let's say in the next 10 or 20 years, we're still not able to engineer something that is as small and as efficient as a brain, as an insect visual system to do vision processing. Well, then how about this? Rather than taking an intact insect, you can genetically engineer the portion of the insect that you need. So let's say you're interested in a single compound eye visual system. So you make a genetic modification to some insect. Let's say you genetically modify a dragonfly, and it grows an extra eye someplace. And you take that extra eye, and you clip it off, and you figure out a way to interface with it and keep it alive, and you use it as a visual sensor. Now, maybe the extra eye thing sounds like total fantasy science fiction. However, it's actually not. It's already known that you can make a genetic modification in a small fruit fly called Drosophila and grow what's called an ectopic eye, which is basically just an extra eye that grows on a leg. So it's not all that unreasonable to think we could genetically engineer the system that we would want and actually use it.
It's interesting all you're saying about using insects or parts of insects, I guess, as a sensory system. I have also heard of work about cyborg insects, so insects that are actually not only are their the outputs of their eyes are they red, but they're actually controlled, and their wings or their legs are controlled by outside stimulus, by a computer. What do you know about that, and what do you think about that?
Well, actually, there is a project funded by DARPA that's going on here at the University of Arizona as in collaboration with several other places. And so I have a little knowledge about that. But what I understand they're attempting is to implant a device inside an insect as it sort of grows up that allows it to be controlled via some external control system or to be pre-programmed to go to some particular place. And I have some skepticism as to whether this will be functional. So basically, the intact insect is set up to do some very specific things. It needs to find food. It needs to mate. It has certain requirements that come to it from its biology. To overcome those requirements to fulfill a military mission is not trivial at all. So to overcome several hundred million years of evolution and simply make the insect fly to some GPS coordinate will not be a trivial task. And so I think taking an intact insect and making it into a sensor is going to require some more significant modification to the insect than what is being done at the moment. There's a very ambitious project that is attempting to basically turn insects into covert surveillance vehicles. And I think that we're probably not at the point where that's going to work in the next year or two.
Okay. Are there any ethical questions to be considered? I mean, I guess you're using a simple organism like an insect, but some people might take some sort of offense to using biological systems and strapping them onto robots. Do you think this is a problem?
Well, this is something that I have thought about from time to time. So I really have a sensation, although I can't prove it, that insects have nothing like consciousness. Insects have no, or perhaps a very, very low level of the self-awareness that we humans have. So I don't feel particularly, and this is a personal choice, any ethical issues about working with insects on my robots or working with insects in my laboratory. Even at the level of mice and rats, I start to have some ethical issues, and certainly when you get to cats and monkeys, we all have ethical issues. So I have never had anybody express to me any troubles with my working with flies. Everybody loves dragonflies because they're beautiful, but as long as there's more dragonflies, I don't think people particularly mind. However, let's take what I'm doing and extrapolate it a little bit. So the equipment that I'm using to record from dragonfly brains could certainly be used to record from rat brains. So you could take a rat. You could put a rat on board a robot and use its brain to control the motion of the robot. And fundamentally, there's very little difference, aside from the surgery, from what I'm doing right now with the dragonfly. So if you could do that, how about taking it all the way up to a human level? So how about now let's interface a fighter pilot's brain to an F-22 fighter and allow him to fly directly? I think a lot of us will have ethical issues with that, particularly when it becomes required, because your physical hand response time is too slow. You really need to fly directly from the brain if you want to be a fighter pilot. So I think the whole issue of bio-interfacing has some severe ethical concerns. I think I'm bypassing that entirely in my own work by working with insects. But the whole bio-interfacing issue, there are some serious issues to be thought about.
So as a final question, maybe tell us about your view of the future of insects and robotics and whether we're just going to kind of figure out everything we need to know and then engineer our own systems, or do you actually see insects being integrated somehow into robotics?
Well, the way I'm thinking about it at the moment, there are certain things that our computing systems are very good at. And so there's no brain that can match a modern computer in processing numbers. This is just something that we're ridiculously faster at. On the other hand, brains, even insect brains, are far better at processing visual or auditory or olfactory information than any computer that we've been able to build. There's just no way to match even insect visual performance on an artificial system at this point. So I'm wondering if the best place for computing to sit in 20 years is not at some hybrid of the two. So imagine a computer system that may be in a black box like we're used to seeing, but some parts of it may be artificial silicon circuits, maybe von Neumann machines like we're used to seeing, and some part of it may be living neural tissue or living tissue of some sort doing computation to subserve whatever task that computer is for. And maybe the visual, maybe there's a visual system in there with a little eye that's sticking out that recognizes you. And maybe there's a cortical system in there that thinks about things and decides how to respond. And the system that is the conventional artificial system does all the computations. It communicates via Ethernet. It does all the things that our computers do now. So it's an interesting place to think about. If you could make the best combination of biological systems and artificial systems, what kind of computers, what kind of robots could you make?
Well, that sounds like a brave new world indeed. Thanks a lot, Chuck, for your time.
My pleasure.
And all the best in your work.
Thank you very much.
Steve Potter is professor in the Laboratory for Neuroengineering at Georgia Tech. He was the first to hook in vitro neurons to robots in an effort to study learning and memory. The resulting semi-living systems are controlled by a brain grown in a petri dish and have artificial bodies. Having the brain in the dish makes it easier to get a sneak peek into what's going on and even provide treatment ideas for patients with epilepsy.
Hi, Steve. Welcome to Robots.
Hello, Sabine. This is a great honor. I'm a fan of this show and listen to it often, so it's really wonderful to be on it.
Excellent. Can you maybe present yourself to our listeners?
Okay. I'm a professor of biomedical engineering in the Laboratory for Neuroengineering at Georgia Tech. That's in Atlanta in the United States. And my department is also shared with Emory University's Medical School, which is nearby Georgia Tech. I am a neuroscientist and an engineer. My PhD is in neuroscience, but I do have built a lot of things, and I love to work with my hands and build things. And so my department is ideal for that because I can be both. I study learning and memory and network dynamics. So what does that mean? We are interested in finding out what changes about your brain when you learn something. So hopefully your listeners, as they're listening to this, are having a few of their neurons altered in some way so that after the show, their brains will be a bit different. And we, at the present, don't really understand how that works. So my lab is trying to chip away at that large stone of ignorance and hopefully answer some questions about physically what changes about brains when you learn something.
We just spoke with Chuck Higgins, who is interfacing robots with fully developed insect brains. And you have been looking at a bottom-up approach and trying to understand basically how the brain functions. You've been looking at developing a brain or growing a brain and then interfacing it to a robot. First of all, how do you grow a brain and sustain it?
Okay. Maybe I'll introduce the concept of in vitro neuroscience. In vitro means in glass, and it means that we grow brain cells in a petri dish, and the ones that we use are very special petri dishes that are instrumented with electrodes. They're built into the bottom of the dish, 60 electrodes that we can hook up to the computer, and we can use our electronics to either stimulate the cells in the dish or we can record their activity. So these are cultured neural networks. So they're actually living cells that we got from rat embryos. And we dissect the cortex and dissociate the cells and pour them into the dish, and they settle down on the surface and start growing and forming connections. And we make time-lapse movies with our microscopes of this process while they're growing. They're submerged in a bath of liquid that is basically what's in your blood, minus the blood cells. It's all the vitamins and salts that you need to keep brain cells alive. We put them in an incubator to keep them warm at body temperature. We control the atmosphere carefully so that the medium that they're in stays the right pH. So they're very touchy cells. Unlike other cultured cells, neurons don't divide. So whatever cells we put in the dish at the beginning of the experiment are all the cells that we get for the entire experiment, which could last for months. Sometimes we grow these cells for months. We've actually grown one culture for 2 years. So we have to spend quite a bit of effort preventing these from getting any germs in them. If the petri dish gets even one bacterium in there, the culture will die. So it doesn't have its own immune system like a brain in your body does. And I should say that a cultured network, calling it a brain is probably overstretching the truth a bit. There are maybe 50,000 brain cells in there, but they don't have nearly as much organization as an intact brain. So that's a plus or a minus. It's a plus because it's much simpler and we might understand it more easily than we can understand an intact brain. But the obvious minus is that whatever we learn may or may not be relevant to intact brains in humans. So we have to keep on reminding ourselves that in vitro neuroscience has its limitations.
What can you learn from growing this brain?
Well, I'll get more specific about some of the things that we're interested in for studying learning and memory. For example, these networks, as they're growing, the cells start communicating with each other with small electrical impulses that we pick up with our electrodes. And those things are called action potentials. Now, these are the signals that go down your nerves from your brain to your muscles that get the muscle to contract or they get your glands to secrete something. In our dishes, sometimes these signals, when we pick them up, are used to control robots. So we were the first ones to connect cultured neural networks to robots. I think that was in year 2000. And we use them as a visualization tool to see whether or not the networks are learning. So if you just have a network in a petri dish, you can't really tell what's going on in there. What is it thinking or what does this activity represent? But if you embody this network by hooking it up to a robot so that its activity can drive the robot around, say the K-Team's Kepra robot is one that we've used, then you can see if there's any change in the activity patterns that changes the behavior of the robot. You can also take the sensory signals from the robot's sensors, such as infrared proximity sensors, which is what the Kepra has. You can take that and encode it into stimulation patterns that you deliver to the cultured neural network. So we built software and hardware to make a closed-loop system whereby the cultured neural network's activity moves the robot, it behaves in the laboratory environment, its sensors pick up new signals, and those get transmitted back into the dish, where hopefully they'll make some change and the robot will learn something. So one of the advantages of in vitro neuroscience approach is that we can take this cultured neural network and put it on the microscope and look at it in great detail and see what's going on in there even while it's behaving, which is very hard to do with an animal because animals move, right? So all that movement makes it hard to do any kind of microscopic imaging. So if you want to look with a microscope and see how brains are thinking, it really helps if you have a simplified brain in a petri dish.
Let's concentrate a bit on one of the more recent projects you've done, which is the semi-living artist. Can you present this project to us?
Okay. The semi-living artist's name is MEART, M-E-A-R-T, and that stands for multi-electrode array art. So the multi-electrode array is the instrumented petri dish that we use. And MEART is a collaboration that we have had since about the year 2002 with a art science collective at the University of Western Australia in Perth, and the collective is called Symbiotica. And the fellow who we collaborate with there is named Guy Ben-Ari, and he works with a robot artist named Phil Gamblin. They built this beautiful arm that draws on large sheets of paper. And when I first met those two, they were controlling this arm with some neurons that they got from goldfish. So they called it fish and chips because they were trying to grow these goldfish neurons on silicon chips. So I said, we could probably control that robot arm also with neurons in our lab in Atlanta. And we set up the system to do that, which means that my hardworking grad students figured out how to communicate over the internet clear across the globe. Atlanta's pretty much exactly on the opposite side of the globe from Perth. And have the signals of the cultured neural network drive this thing around and cause it to draw drawings. And there's a camera there in Perth, or actually this thing went on tour and has been all over the world. So wherever it happens to be, this camera is sending signals back to Atlanta through the internet. And those signals get translated into some kind of electrical stimulus that we deliver to the cultured network. And we use that to try to train the network, hopefully to draw something that we could recognize. I have to say that it still is at the toddler scribbling level, but it's very interesting in a philosophical sense that this is a half-living, half-mechanical entity that can express some kind of creativity. In other words, the activity of the network really is what determines how the drawing looks. And the kind of thing that we have learned by playing around with MEART is that when it's being exhibited for, say, 2 weeks at some art exhibit, it will be getting stimulation all the time, pretty much. It'll be drawing and looking at its drawings, and we've observed that after a while, that stimulation tended to calm the network down. So previously, the drawings might have been rather erratic, and there was lots of activity, and as the thing drew, it moved less, and the network had less of this spontaneous activity. So this actually has resulted in a spin-off that our lab is doing, a medical spin-off that we're now using electrical stimulation to calm epilepsy in experimental animals. And if it works, then we obviously would like to try this out in humans who have intractable epilepsy. So even though this is a very fanciful project, MEART, it has some tangible benefits when you look at the science behind it.
Is there a reward mechanism to direct the learning?
That's a very good question. In the brain, in intact brains, we have very complex circuitry that does the rewarding and allows certain connections to be strengthened, say, by releasing neurotransmitters such as dopamine. In our culture dishes, we don't have this complex circuitry. So one approach we can do is to apply the reward chemically with some sort of a miniature spritzer, called Pico Spritzer, actually. So we can put dopamine or some chemical like that into the spritzer. And we built a system that allowed the network to apply its own dopamine if it had accomplished something that the robot was supposed to do, something that we say was a good thing. And we weren't successful in getting this to induce any learning, so we have a lot more work to do to understand how does dopamine cause these changes in connections. So you could also say that neurons and neural networks, the brains, most of the brain cells in your brain, are devoted to noticing coincidences. They're looking at the world around them and the inputs and trying to find out what's related to what. And when they find that out, they make connections between those two different things. So so at the psychological level, we call it associations, and at the cellular level, we might just call it the synapse. But it's, you could say it's intrinsically rewarding to these cells to do that because it's something that's very hard to get them not to do. They really want to form associations. And so we have to work hard in our culture dishes to prevent this happening if we wanted to. And basically, if you just give a network lots of inputs, it will start to notice associations and strengthen connections between them.
So what are the future steps with this semi-living artist?
Okay, so Mayart, the robot that draws on large pieces of paper, has actually been retired to give way to a new thing that the folks in Perth have created called Silent Barrage. This thing was presented in New York recently, and it consists of a room full of pillars that are controlled by our neurons here in the lab in Atlanta. They are robotic pillars, you could say. They have this mechanism that spins around the pillar and can move up and down the pillar and draw on paper that's been wrapped around the pillar. So each one of these pillars represents one of the electrodes in our culture dish, and the height of this thing spinning around is represented or represents how much activity that electrode is recording from the brain cells. So what the effect is as you walk through this room of pillars is you have all of these things moving up and down and spinning around and making a lot of racket, which is you experiencing the ongoing activity of this culture dish. And there's some kind of a feedback system where there's cameras above watching the visitors to the gallery, and where they happen to walk is where the stimulation goes. So we pick up the images and we translate those into stimuli that try to excite the network based on where the people are and what they're doing. And there's a lot of technical glitches that still need to be worked out. That you could say that first exhibit was a beta test. It's hopefully going to go on exhibit in Europe soon, and they're going to improve some of those things. But this is an interesting art-science collaboration that has really helped us get scientists talking about art and artists talking about science and seeing how they can contribute to each other.
Do you think this new environment will help with the learning, or is it more for the art?
So far this situation in Silent Barrage that we've set up doesn't have a specific goal that it's trying to learn. You could say that it's just trying to absorb the information about where the attendees are and respond to it. So it's more of a stimulus response thing. We hoped, however, that after a while we'll see some changes in those stimulus responses, and then we'll start to study some kind of a learning effect. So I'd say at this point it's much more of an art project than a science project. Our studies with wheeled mobile robots are more scientific, and in that case we're trying to get them to solve some very simple navigation tasks by training them with certain kinds of patterned electrical stimulation.
I'm curious, where do you now stand with these wheeled robots?
So we have recently published a paper in which we managed to accomplish, after about 8 years of trying, getting the network to control a robot to move in a certain direction by electrically stimulating it. So we previously were able to change the networks with stimulation, but we weren't able to predict ahead of time what kind of changes we could induce. So this is the first example of successful goal-directed learning in a cultured network that controls a robot. So it required us to come up with sort of like an evolutionary scheme for training the network with patterns of electrical stimulation, and we start out with a bunch of random patterns, and we keep applying them to the network until the robot does the right thing, and then we use the ones that worked to train it. We keep on applying those more and more often, and eventually, after a few minutes, we managed to get the network to control the robot correctly. And then we studied how does it forget, and we stop the training process and see how long it continues to behave properly. And it, so far, it seems to remember things only for about 90 minutes. So obviously, we have a long way to go in understanding the brain processes of learning and memory and forgetting.
You raised an important issue before in that you're trying to have these robots be creative and show intelligent behavior. To what extent do you think, if this robot displays a creative behavior, for example, you're considered as a living being or as a machine?
Yes, well, I would say I think of these as semi-living. You know, they consist of actual, real, live, living tissue that we have to feed and take care of. And there's a lot of metabolism going on, and if you look at it under the microscope, you will be stunned by how complicated it all is. So there's no doubt in my mind that it's alive. To call it an animal usually is it's something that most people aren't willing to accept, so we use the word animat. We say that it's a simulated animal of some kind that either is simulated in a robotic form, or it could be just a simulation on the computer that's being controlled by the neurons. So we call it a semi-living animal or an animat, and I'm perfectly happy to entertain other points of view on how much alive it is or isn't. As I said before, it's missing a lot of the crucial circuitry that's in intact brains.
Thanks, Steve, for being here with us on Robots.
This has been my pleasure. Thank you, Sabine.
That's it for this episode of Robots. For more information on our guests, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. And of course, don't forget to stop by the forum for discussion on today's show and other hot topics in robotics.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Connect your brain to Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.